Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For 140 years, the Grater's name has endured in the ice cream world, maintaining an upscale image while spreading that image across the country. It started in Cincinnati, and you can read all about it in the new book by Dispatch food editor Robin Davis. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Thank you.
Now, should I call you Robin Davis Heigl or?
I know. Why did I decide to do this? You know, I write for the Dispatch, and I do work for 10TV, and it's Robin Davis, and that's something of a brand. This was completely outside of it. My married name, I've been married now almost 7 years, and I thought, okay, finally I need to take my husband's name. So you can call me anything. You can call me you, and I'll probably answer.
Okay. Well, you, what makes Grater's worth writing about now? It's 140 years, so it's a milestone kind of a thing, but what otherwise what?
Well, it's still a family-owned company, which is very, very unusual. It is a fourth generation now, and less than 3% of family-owned companies get to that fourth generation. The more people are in the family, the harder it is to divide it up. And frankly, a lot of companies, the family just isn't interested in maintaining it. Grater's was different.
At its heart, I found it was the story of a very strong woman. And you and I were talking earlier, every step along the way, it took certain special people to make it survive as long as it has. For one thing, the guy who started it in the first place, but then his wife. Tell us about what happened to him and how his wife took the helm.
Well, Lewis Charles actually started it just as a way to make money. And then he was kind of a scoundrel. He left his wife at the time, moved to California, left his business, left her with all kinds of debt, got married again, then decided he didn't like California either. Came back to Cincinnati. The first wife was gone. Actually, it was the second wife at that point. His brother had taken over the Grater's ice cream business. And so he came back in and took it over again. Then he met Regina Berger. And I really think it was Regina who made the company, started the company on what it is today. Regina was much younger than Lewis Charles, and she really had a passion for it. Lewis Charles died in a tragic accident. He was hit by a trolley. He was 67 years old, and he left his young wife with two young children. It was 1919, and she couldn't even vote. But here she was, you know, the owner of this company. So she really took it in her hands to make the company what it is. And she worked with her children and then her grandchildren. Everyone, by the way, they didn't call her mom. They didn't call her grandma. They called her the boss.
Everybody.
Everybody called her the boss.
Isn't it interesting? Because she couldn't vote then. The vote came along about a year later.
Right.
But what do we know about what she was thinking when she decided to pursue to take the helm the way she did?
I think what it was survival. I love this company. I love what we do. I know we can make it work. And I know I can make it work. I think that's what she was thinking. It was also, I have to provide for these two young sons. So I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. And then in the 1920s and then into the 30s, she expanded the business. I mean, here we were in the Great Depression, and she decides, I'm going to buy a plant. I'm going to open more stores. She wasn't willing to just sit back and take the normal route. She really was going to expand that business, and she did.
And you mentioned that she did it during a really tough period of time and expanded it even more during the Great Depression.
She did.
And there was a little tidbit in there. You said that something that we do know about, for some reason, certain kinds of luxuries never go out of style, no matter how hard up we are.
And that's remained true till today. In the 80s, when there was a recession, ice cream did very, very well. Right now, the recession that we're coming out of, ice cream sales have been very good. We can talk about Jenny's Ice Cream. Their business has been expanding. Grater's Ice Cream, the people who own the franchises in Kentucky, said 2009, the horrible year for everyone else, their best year ever. So I think what it is people can say, all right, I can't go on a vacation. Maybe I can't even go out to dinner, but I can go out for ice cream, and it's going to be $2.50 a scoop.
And it feels kind of special.
It feels very special. And it also, it's something that I think makes you feel good at a time maybe when we're not feeling very good about other things.
We're talking about ice cream specifically right now, Grater's Ice Cream, and book Grater's, An Irresistible History by Robin Davis Heigl. That's Robin Davis of the Columbus Dispatch and Channel 10 Television. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you want to email us, it's allsides@wosu.org. You can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can go to you can Twitter us at Ann Fisher, WOSU. We'll take your questions and comments any way you want. What about Grater's ice cream stands out, though? You said they still make it in the, 2 to 3 gallon batches?
Right.
So that's one thing, but still.
Well, that alone is actually kind of a crazy thing for them to still be doing. Even small artisan makers make it in bigger batches. But they never got away from that original, it's called the French pot method. And they take their ice cream mixture, they put it in these cylindrical pots, and they spin it, and then they hand scoop it still. They hand pack it into containers. Now, there are other companies that make it, and they make multiple commercial batch, big batch production. They can make way more ice cream than Grater's can or does. I think that's what really keeps the product special. In ice cream language, they talk about high butterfat and low overrun. Yeah. Because if you've ever noticed, there are some store brands, value brands that are very fluffy in texture. And Grater's isn't that way. You don't get very much air at all mixed in. And it has a very high butterfat. So I think that the product itself really is something to that's very special, something to write about.
Is the density of the ice cream a function of the French pot method? How does that
it work? Is
okay.
Because they don't mix in very much air. Some of the commercial producers will push in a lot more air. If you weigh a pint of Grater's ice cream, it'll weigh about a pound. You can get some value brands that weigh half that. It really is a matter of air, and that's what gives you the texture. And then, of course, there are the flavors, and they don't use unnatural ingredients. Everything is all natural and locally sourced from the Cincinnati area. You know, they're very reliant on the dairies, the Ohio and the Kentucky dairies, to get that. That part of their ice cream.
They do seasonal variations mm-hmm. on a theme, and I wish they would do more. I'm just taking a chance to exploit my operation. The green
pistachio.
Mm-hmm. It's very limited batch, and it's very upsetting to me. Peppermint at Christmas time, pumpkin mm-hmm. in the fall.
But look what it does. It makes you keep wanting to come back
to check.
Do they have it? They have a very seasonal schedule. And if you follow along, you can, in fact, I think on their website, you can see what's going to be coming out. They have peach ice cream right now. It's almost at the end. We'll start getting into pumpkin and nutmeg flavors. And I think that's a great marketing thing. They also can't handle having all these ice creams out there all the time. And they'll also do, on occasion, they'll do special ice creams that'll only be even at one store, maybe. Maybe two. I was in Kentucky over the weekend, and there was a woman saying that she had tried a banana pie ice cream at a Grater store in Louisville.
I already like that.
I know. It sounds terrific, doesn't it? And I think it was only there, and it was just being tried out. Who knows if we'll ever see it, you know, here in Columbus or ever in a pint in Kroger or anywhere else.
614-292-8513. And Bill, welcome to the show. You're on the air with Robin Davis.
Hello. I wanted to share with you just something about my father, who was born in 1904,
mm-hmm.
and he lived in Walnut Hills and went to the Grater store when he was a child. I imagine we're talking around 1914 or something like this. In
right.
Walnut Hills, I believe at Gilbert and McMillan, someplace close to that.
Mm-hmm. The McMillan store was the original store.
It was yes. Mm-hmm. And I think for my dad, who was about 10 years old then, for him, really, it was more of a source, I think, of penny candy for his sister and he who used mm-hmm. to go in there. But I remember he used to take me there in the 50s. It was always a nice event when we went downtown to the Walnut Street store down there. And I actually used to eat caramel ice cream, which unfortunately I don't think is a regular of theirs anymore, but which both my father and I loved. But anyway, usually we'd sit down to eat a little Grater's, which was always the best ice cream in the world because it coated the top of your mouth with this great feeling, unlike any other. And he would always say, you know, I remember when old Baldy Grater used to mix this stuff up in his cellar, who I assume was Lewis.
That was
right?
Lewis Charles, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's it, but I just wanted to share that.
Thank you so much. That's a great story.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Bill. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we're starting to Twitter now, so at Ann Fisher, WOSU is where you want to go for that. The transition from that third to fourth generation was difficult.
That was a very tricky transition. All of the transitions had been a little bit tragic, a little bit tough. You know, Lewis Charles died, then his sons took over. The sons didn't get along at all. And it wasn't until Regina, until the boss died, that finally Wilmer bought it out from Paul. But those two historically had not gotten along at all. Then Wilmer had five children. He had three sons who came into the business, and then he had two daughters, one that wanted nothing to do with the business and one that came into the business but was not an owner. She wasn't considered an owner. And then one of the sons eventually got out of the business. In 1989, he had an accident and decided he wanted to be through with the business, sold his shares to his sister, Kathy. So then there were the three owners. But when it needed to transition to the fourth generation, there was Kathy, who had no children. There was Lou, who had two children, Chip and Bob, who are interested. And there was Dick, who had one, he had two children, but one that was interested in the business. How do you divide that up equitably? You know, what is the right way, the right percentage? And that was difficult for the family. It was also difficult because the fourth generation had different ideas than what the third generation did. The third generation was extremely hands-on. You know, they were still in there making the ice cream and driving trucks to deliver the ice cream. And the fourth generation knew that in order for it to work, they were going to have to be able to take a step back. But the company wasn't really set up that way. Mm-hmm. So they went through a very tough time, and they were very, very open with me about it. This book was really based primarily on interviews with them, with the generations that are still here, the people who are still here. And they admitted that they had a lot of family conflict and getting that worked out. And they did finally go to a family business psychologist at the University of Cincinnati.
Who knew?
Who knew they existed, right? Well, they said a friend of Rich Grader, who's now the CEO of the company, said, you know, he had a friend who told him, you don't need any more lawyers and you don't need any more consultants. You need a psychologist. And they went, and it took years still, but they helped them work through all their differences.
And they was that where at the point where they branded it to what it is now?
Right after the fourth generation took over, they did decide that they needed to brand it and to expand it. They had been kind of haphazard. If you had ever been to the stores, even the Columbus franchise stores, they all looked kind of different. They might have different color schemes, different versions of the logo. So they consolidated all of that. So now the logo and really all of their products have a very similar appearance, which I think is very important for a business and something usually that's what you start with, you know, and this company didn't. That's kind of something they've done in the fourth generation to have a, you know, a logo and a mantra that all came in the fourth generation.
And they really enjoyed that branding experience, or at least one of the brothers mm-hmm. did.
I think they all did. I think what it made them realize, possibly for the first time, is what a wonderful product they had and what a great opportunity they had. I think when Louis Charles started everything, when Regina took over, it was like, yeah, this is what we do and this is what we're doing to make a living. And that's kind of how everyone took it. They knew the product was good, but I don't think it was until they sat down and said, okay, really, what is our motto? What do we believe in? I think it was at that point they said, we want to make the best ice cream in the world. And so that's kind of when they come back to that decision, it makes it a little bit easier for them.
We're going to have to take a break. My guest is Robin Davis, Columbus Dispatch food editor and author of The New Graders, An Irresistible History. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to give us a question or comment. You're welcome. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here from 2 until 4 this afternoon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 90 degrees. A few clouds tonight, a low of 65. Sunshine for Tuesday and a slight chance of rain, a high of 92.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
Well, Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Robin Davis, Columbus Dispatch food editor and author of the new book, Graters, An Irresistible History. Robin, what inspired you to do this story now? Like I said, what struck you about it?
Why now, right? Yeah. Well, it actually wasn't my idea. History Press is a small publishing house in South Carolina, and they came to me because they do very small local histories. They came to me because they mistakenly believe that Graters was a Columbus business.
A lot of people do.
They do, because there are so many scoop shops here. And if you've never been to Cincinnati, you kind of don't realize it didn't start here. So they came to me looking for a writer. They thought, well, the food editor might be able to write that. And I didn't turn it down. And, you know, I'm a huge ice cream fan. And a big Graters fan. So it's like, oh, you want me to write about ice cream? I can do that. So it wasn't my idea. But the thing that really interested me was that whole family aspect. I had not grown up eating Graters, but since I had moved to Columbus, since my sister had moved to Columbus, in fact, I had been eating it for years. And I really enjoyed it. In fact, when I lived in California, I always made a point of saying when I came back to Columbus to see my sister, it's like, where are we going? We're going to Graters. Maybe we're going to Graters every day. And I loved it.
Because you couldn't get anything like that out there?
Do you know, there are some people who say there's this artisan ice cream revolution in California. I didn't see it. There was a place called Mitchell's that did terrific but very exotic, crazy flavors. Like they had a flavor called Young Coconut that was good. And there was Swenson's ice cream that was kind of an old family ice cream, probably the closest thing to what Graters is. But those were a single scoop shops, and that was really it. There was Double Rainbow that you could get at a couple stores, kind of like the Ben and Jerry's, but there really wasn't anything like this. I think that San Francisco in particular, which is where I spent most of my time, is a little more creative than that. Like they're really going to push the envelope and they're going to be doing crazier flavors. And I was a restaurant critic at that point. So if I was eating dessert, I was eating it in restaurants. So it was nice to be able to go out just to a good old-fashioned scoop shop when I came to Columbus.
Now, Columbus is getting better and better known for Jenny's as well. That's an amazing story, too.
It is, absolutely. And it seems that whenever people talk about Graters, they talk about Graters and Jenny's kind of in the same breath. And they want to know, oh, is that competition? I haven't actually asked Jenny, but I know that Rich Grater says, we don't really look at it that way. I think we're opposite sides of kind of that same high-end ice cream. Jenny's, as you know, it's got its scoop shops here, and then it's available at very exclusive markets, including Dean and DeLuca in Manhattan, and they also charge a premium price for their ice creams. Their flavors are also way more out there than Graters will ever be, and Graters is fine with that. Graters is going to be that old-fashioned, all-American, butter pecan, mint chocolate chip ice cream, and that's not Jenny's market. That's not what she's doing.
So there was this market out there. Jenny tapped into it. When you drive by in the short north, it's out the door.
Every day. And there's one in Dublin where I live, and I have never been in there and been able to walk right up to the counter and get my ice cream. Never. I think it's happened once or twice in Grandview, but that was a few years ago. I think that there is a great market for artisan ice cream, and I think that people are really, really interested in that. Now, last week there was an article in the New York Times about artisan ice cream, and Jenny's is not the only one in the country. But there's definitely this kind of, I guess people are watching because the prices seem to be so high, even by New York standards. A pint of Jenny's ice cream is $10 here if you buy it at her store. It's more than that in New York. I've heard, I can't confirm it, but I've heard that there's a store in Michigan where they're charging $14 a pint. Mm-hmm. And that's not even the most expensive artisan ice cream. There is the one, is it called Milkmaid, Milky Maid? You get three pints for $50. And I think, really? Now, go to the backstory on Jenny's, though, and she is using exclusively Snowville Creamery cream. So that's from Pomeroy, Ohio. She uses single-source chocolates. She uses locally sourced fruits. And all of that adds up. She spares absolutely no expense when it comes to making her ice cream. So is it worth it? I think customers have to decide that. When you stand back and look at it, you know she's not gouging customers.
You can't get it anywhere else.
No. No. I mean, you can have it shipped to you. There are a handful of very small stores that have it. But you can't go into a scoop shop anywhere but Columbus right now.
Yeah. And she is expanding.
She is. She is. I mean, how many stores is she opening now? Two more? I remember when it was just at the North Market, and
right.
that was the only place you could get it. And now you can get it almost everywhere. What were you saying? You were hoping for one in Worthington?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hint, hint. This is the hint show today.
And, it is a great product. It really is. You can't go wrong with that. Though I do hear some people complaining about the price. A scoop of Jenny's ice cream is $4. A pint is $10. You know, for me, I have to admit that until the New York Times called me about this story last week, I wasn't really paying attention to prices, not of Grater's, not of Jenny's, because for me, it was still that luxury item. I don't keep ice cream for the most part in my house unless I'm wanting to serve it on top of something else. I want to go out for ice cream. So if I go out for ice cream, I apparently don't notice if it's $2.50 a scoop or $4 a scoop.
Right.
It's still affordable to me.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to Ann Fisher, WOSU, if you want to Twitter. Robin Davis is my guest, and we're talking about ice cream, but we can easily move on to many, many other things, because Robin was a food critic. She is a food editor for the Columbus Dispatch. She's a wonderful are you considered a chef? I think of you as a great cook.
Well, I guess technically I could have that title. I did go to the California Culinary
right.
Academy. I graduated from there. I'm not sure if that's what earns you the title. When I graduated, they gave me the tall toque, you know, the big
uh-huh.
tall paper hat. But I never worked in a restaurant as a chef. So I would say no. I would say I'm a great cook, or someone at least who loves to cook.
Do you ever sit back and get amazed at the food revolution?
I do all the time, and I do sort of from both sides. I think here in Columbus, one of the things that impresses me is that we have the people who are still very set in the, you know, cream of chicken soup, casseroles, and that's what they want. And then we have this whole almost underground food scene where people are seriously interested in local, unusual, very interested in supporting farmers and ranchers. I think it's fabulous.
Let's see. We do have an email. It's from George. Where can one go to learn the basics of cooking? I am intimidated by recipes calling for me to peel garlic, use fresh herbs, and zest a lemon. Okay.
Well, that's a great question. We have some cooking classes at the North Market in the Dispatch Kitchen, which is where we tape our segments for Channel 10. We also open that up for cooking classes, but they aren't hands-on classes. So I think that if you're looking for that, you might check out Sur La Table. They have great classes, Sur La Table out at Easton. Williams-Sonoma occasionally has classes. I don't think they're hands-on, though.
Edible Columbus is doing
stuff. I don't know if they're doing hands-on or not,
okay.
But I know that they're also doing great classes. And then Wild Goose also is doing some cooking classes. That I heard about recently. So those are all terrific sources. And frankly, for some things, you can watch things, not so much the Food Network, but you can watch public television and find some great things. Just watch what they're doing. The chefs like Jacques Pepin and Rick Bayless, of course.
Of course.
They have great skills, and they really show them more, I think, than they do on the Food Network.
Rick was here last spring, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I was sorry that you couldn't go to the chefs. Now I'm blanking out.
Somebody's the Chefs gonna, in the City.
Thank you. Chefs in the City. Rick Bayless was here. That kind of teaching method, though, to be mm-hmm. watching must be effective because it's very, very popular. It's made Food Network.
Well, it has. But if you pay attention to the Food Network, it's way more entertaining than it is teaching. It started as teaching and where they showed a lot of different techniques. And it's almost exclusively now entertainment. If you watch, and you especially if you watch the chefs, watch what they're doing. I'm thinking nobody at home is in their right mind is ever going to try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you watch public television, you really can. If you watch Lydia Bastianich, I mean, I feel like she's standing in my kitchen and is there teaching me. There, again, it's two different avenues. One is very entertaining, will definitely make you want to cook or at least eat.
Mm-hmm.
The other one will teach you a lot more.
614-292-8513. I don't know if we had another email or not, but no. Okay. So it's been a good growing year.
Great
hot,
growing year.
Mm-hmm. Pretty wet.
Mm-hmm. It's had good and bad sides. You know, we had that great warm spring, and then we had rain every day. And I know there were some farms that were struggling. But I think we've kind of hit a great, great period.
My tomatoes are much better this year than they were last year. So what inspires you from the garden right now?
I have had what I call a peachy summer. I just can't get enough of peaches. In fact, Cindy Decker, the Home and Garden editor, brought me in this huge bag of peaches from a tree in her yard.
Cindy.
We love you, Cindy. it was great. And I already had peaches that I'd gotten from my CSA. I just can't get enough of them. My sister went out and picked peaches in Utica. So I'm crazy in love with peaches. And the thing is, you really only get peaches every couple of years here that are really good. And then you just have to hope that the ones coming up from Georgia are okay. And then this time of year, too, I think we're lucky. I'd heard the big scare about basil. And, you know, we'll never get it. And there are some growers that don't have it. My basil is doing great. Great, though. And again, Cindy Decker brought me a huge bag.
I had one
basil
plant that just bombed. Mm-hmm. I'd never had it bomb before. And then I had another one that's I planted it later and it's doing okay.
Now, did it get the mildewy?
The first one did. The second one, I think it just planted later, so it doesn't have the growing season. But it also avoided whatever. Yeah, the mildewy thing.
Yeah, it's really a problem. I think on the East Coast and the Northeast, they're really having, I mean, this isn't tragic, right? A shortage of basil. Nobody's going to starve from that. No. But it's very sad in the summer. I thought, I can't imagine not having basil because I will use basil every single day. I'll use it on tomatoes. I use it on pasta. I put it on a sandwich instead of lettuce because I love it so much. So that's definitely something that's right up there in my summertime inspiration.
So producer Amy Jurovich says that her basil's great. Her dill's also doing well. So you know where you can dump that basil off, you know, Amy, when you get a chance. We have a call now from Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, ladies. A wonderful week for ice cream. Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream.
That's right.
Whatever happened to two of my favorite flavors when I was a youngster many years ago? Chico March used to say Tootsie Footsie. You girls are old enough to remember Chico, probably not.
Tutti Frutti, I remember.
Tutti Frutti, yeah. He pronounced it Tootsie Footsie.
Okay.
And, I'm going back too far. And the other, orange pineapple.
Hmm. Were those Grater's flavors?
I don't know if they were Grater's or not. But by the way, I do like that, what was that nut you mentioned, Miss Fisher?
Pistachio.
Oh, gosh, I love pistachio.
Grater's pistachio is.
Yeah.
It is really good.
Fantastic, yeah. By the way, idea for another book.
I'm always up for that.
Either of you ever been to Young's Dairy Farm?
Oh, yes. Now, see, I didn't grow up with Grater's. It's in Yellow Springs. I love Young's Dairy because we used to go out there. You can go out and pet the cows and the goats, and then truly they make the ice cream there. Now, my understanding is they actually don't produce enough milk to make all of the ice cream. But they have a bake shop. They do donuts. In high school, not that I ever stayed out all night in high school. I'm sure I never, ever, ever did that. But it could be said that I was there occasionally early in the morning when they had their fresh donuts, and it was fantastic.
Well, they used to be open 24 hours years ago. In fact, I first discovered it when a friend and myself and our son, who, gosh, was probably about 12 years old then, I'm going back almost close to half a century, but we took a bicycle ride on the old mill trail, bike trail, and of course, we stopped at Young's Dairy Farm.
Right. Well, that's what we used to do when we would go to Clifton Gorge and go hiking. It was always a great excuse to go then to go over there. And Yellow Springs is just such a cool little area.
So is it still there?
It's still there. Alrighty, still operating. Then. You can go and get their ice creams. Again, it's not going to be crazy flavors, but they've got a knockout strawberry ice cream. That was one of my favorites.
Jerry, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. 614-292. We have a few more minutes left with Robin Davis, Columbus Dispatch food editor, author of Grater's and Irresistible History. You've written other books.
I have. The first book I wrote was called Wookiee Cookies, the Star Wars cookbook. And it was one of those right place, right time things. And certainly I wish it was a contract I could renegotiate because I did it for a fee. I get nothing if people buy more of them. And it's sold at last count 80,000, 90,000 books. I mean, it just keeps getting reprinted. It was a totally fun book to do, but we did it in like 6 weeks. Chronicle Publishing had come to me and said, do you want to do this book? They were doing some other books with Lucasfilms. So I did. I said, okay. And we sat around really and came up with names before we came up with recipes, you know. Hahnberger, and it was a kid's book. Uh-huh. So everything was kind of supposed to be Princess Leia, Danish Dews, Yoda Soda. Yeah. So it was just kind of sitting around being silly and then having to turn around and make recipes. And then the photographer, Frankie Frankini, actually did hysterical photos with little tiny the figures, the little Star Wars figures. Uh-huh. So you can still find it in bookstores, and it's kind of still a hilarious book that I hear about every once in a while.
We have an email from a listener. Mm-hmm. Two best things about graters. Your lips always feel moisturized after eating. The chocolate chunks are not only large chunks, but they're very generous with them. In fact, just away from the email, sometimes my whole cone is like ice cream wrapped around a big chunk of chocolate. Does your guest have any information on the blueberry pie flavor? Are they planning on expanding the flavors for a good cause?
Well, that flavor, it was actually brought out. It was brought about because of a little girl. Her name was Elena, and she had brain cancer, and it was a deadly form of brain cancer. And she passed away. Her parents went to the same church as Chip Grater. And so the Graters wanted to do something to help the organization that they were involved in. And off the top of my head, I'm not going to remember the name of it. So they sold the opportunity for someone to be able to make that ice cream, to come up with an ice cream flavor. And that's where the blueberry pie ice cream flavor came from. They were just going to sell it during the month of July and then give the proceeds to the organization. And it was such a popular flavor that they've actually kept it on their menu. So you can get it at all of the Grater stores.
Okay.
Now, one other thing that I can tell you about the chocolate, and maybe you know this, they don't use chocolate chips.
Right.
They actually pour melted chocolate into the semi frozen ice cream near the end of the process. They spin that around until it starts to harden. Then they hand scrape it. So yes, you will often get a huge chunk of chocolate in there, and you'll never get uniform pieces of chocolate in a Grater's ice cream.
You never know. Dale, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I'm a lifetime resident of Columbus. But I remember back in the 50s, we used to go to a place northwest, as I recall. It's all built up now. It's all different. It used to be called Isley. And you could go in there, and it was like gravel parking lot and get your ice cream and a place to sit out there. And we always try to get the cows to come over to the fence so we could pet them. And as it turned out, I worked at a place called the Café Martinique, mm-hmm. Just outside of Bexley. And some of the investors in this was Wexner and Bobby Hill of Hill Distributing, and the Isleys. And I was just curious whatever happened to that whole process. Cause
I don't actually mention them. It was one of a couple of things that people have been telling me about since then. And because it was something in Columbus, I really didn't get much into the history of Columbus ice cream. So I don't have very much information for you, but it's definitely something that I want to research.
Oh, it was, as I recall, the best ice cream I ever had, except for family reunions where they made us as kids, crank the machine.
Right. It's hard to top that. Yeah. I agree.
And it's just a matter of anticipation.
It was the best without all the work. How about that?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
Take care.
Really.
That is all the time we have with Robin Davis. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Absolutely,
and we can just
anytime.
Talk food.
Mm-hmm.
I love talking food.
Me too.
So we'll have to do that. Thanks for joining us today, though.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Also want to say Robin will be signing copies of her new book at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore at Polaris Fashion Center on Saturday at 2 p.m., so you can meet her in person there. Robin Davis, Columbus Dispatch food editor and author of Graters and Irresistible History. We're going to be back with Walker Evans in a few minutes. If you stay tuned, 614-292-8 8513, all sides at WOSU.org for email, and go to Ann Fisher at Ann Fisher WOSU if you want to Twitter us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here, and we'll hear about what Central Ohio is doing to prepare for the changes ahead with the aging population and the establishment of lifelong communities. That discussion begins at 11 on All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's News and Entertainment Weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
78 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today and a warm day with a high of 90 degrees. A few clouds tonight, a low of 65. Sunshine for Tuesday and another warm day, a high of 92. There is a slight chance of afternoon rain on Tuesday. And looking ahead to Wednesday, a chance of rain, cloudy skies, and a high of 92. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're switching gears a little bit right now. My guest now is Walker Evans, a ColumbusUnderground.com creator and now a founder of Columbus's new Metropreneur, or The Metropreneur, one of his latest creations. Welcome to the show, Walker.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's an online site dedicated to small business development and entrepreneurialism in Central Ohio. It's kind of a spinoff, you think of it. As why this? Why now?
Well, a couple months ago, my wife Ann and I started talking about what our next project would be. You know, throwing around some different ideas, and we decided to start talking about spinoffs. Columbus Underground covers a very wide range of topics, so there's a lot of things that we kind of hit on from time to time, but don't really cover really in depthly. So the topic that we decided that had kind of the largest need in the community for a full-time resource was small business development and entrepreneurialism. So that's kind of how it was born. We started to do some national research and local research and started to kind of reach out into the small business community and see, you know, what their reaction to this resource would be, what they'd want out of it. Talked to a lot of different folks, and it sounds like it's pretty good timing and the resource is needed.
I was reading, it's kind of a Jenny Britton Bauer kind of a day. We were just talking about ice cream and graters. And now
every day
and now,
is a Jenny's day.
And Jenny's, yeah, exactly. Every day is a Jenny's day. But your first edition, I guess, of the Metropreneur includes a Q&A with Jenny, and founder of Jenny's Ice Creams. And she directs Small Business Wannabe, she said, a Small Business Administration website. But that's not enough.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jenny's was one of our launch articles. We did kind of a two-part article, one on Columbus Underground that kind of talked about the new stores that she's opening in Powell and mm-hmm. Beachwold, the new book that she's writing and that sort of thing. So then the article you're referring to, the kind of the second part on Metropreneur talks about, you're right, she directs people to the SBA website and talks about how they went through the process of setting up their of getting their SBA loan. But then she goes on to give more information about, how they use the North Market as a business incubator to keep their overhead costs low and kind of grow out of that, kind of let them get their feet wet, so to speak. She talks about some of the local people, some of the mentors that they had when they got their business started. They talk about some of the books that they read that helped them write a business plan. And probably some of the best advice she gave was just the fact that she's the creative mind, so she had to find the right partners and the right people to take over, the legal side. Her husband, Charlie, does kind of the business side. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really good advice, that if you are a creative person and you can create a product or create a business and you're not good at the financials or the logistics or some of the other pieces, you need to find partners, people to help you out, that sort of thing. So it's a very in-depth article with her.
My guest is Walker Evans, founder of ColumbusUnderground.com, and also now a new online site dedicated to small business development and entrepreneurialism in Central Ohio. It's called The Metropreneur. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to at Ann Fisher WOSU if you'd like to Twitter your question or comment. What worked about ColumbusUnderground.com, Walker, that you're replicating on the Metropreneur?
Well, we're using the same type of content management system, so it's the site feels a lot very similar to Columbus Underground. I think we we have a strength in kind of providing news from a grassroots level. It's, you know, it's independently owned. So I think we wanted to carry over that same sort of feeling, the same sort of bones of the site, and then just provide, you know, a new focus. So one thing that we are doing a little bit differently with the Metropreneur is we're still doing kind of the news angle. So there'll be, you know, regular updates with interviews, topical articles, focuses on small businesses. But then we also have put together a local resource database. So it's kind of a more static.
Yeah, what is that for? What are people going to use that for?
Well, anyone that's either an aspiring entrepreneur or somebody that already has a small business that's looking to grow, we've put together kind of a catalog of all of the different types of resources that we can find in Central Ohio that they would use, whether it's, you know, acquiring financial assistance, you know, finding marketing or social media consultants to help them, securing office space or retail space for their business. And that database will continue to grow. We launched it with 100 resources, you know, broken down into categories, and it's all searchable. I think we're up to around 125 resources now, just with all the suggestions that have been coming, you know, pouring into us through Twitter and Facebook and other mm-hmm. other ways. But yeah, I mean, we wanted to kind of make a centralized point, because what we found is that there's really no shortage of those types of resources in the community. It's just a matter of finding them and knowing what they are. You know, maybe people know about ECDI, but they're not sure exactly what they do, or they know about the SBDC at Columbus State, but they're not quite sure, you know, is that a financial resource? Do they provide grants? Do they help you write business plans? So we're trying to kind of categorize all that and help people, point people in the right direction.
So a lot of what you did do, a lot of the topics that did spring up on Columbus Underground were small business related. And so how do you distinguish the two now? So if something pops up in the small business entrepreneurial community, are you still going to see something about it on Columbus Underground, or is it going to be directed to Metropreneur?
Definitely, you know, we're continuing to do both. You're right that a lot of what we focus on in Columbus Underground is small business related, but we've mostly approached people, you know, when we do articles or interviews or Q&As, we approach people the mindset of, as a customer coming into this new business or experiencing this new business, what should we expect? So we're still going to continue to do that on Columbus Underground, let people know, you know, if there's a new restaurant opening or a new boutique opening, you know what the customer should expect. And then on the flip side, on the Metropreneur side, what we want to do is talk more about as a business owner, how did you make this happen? How did you get started? What sort of resources out there you used, so that other people reading this that are inspired, and many people, you know, are inspired by folks like Jenny and Charlie, you know, how did they do it? You know, how did they make it happen? If you want to start a business, you know, how did, you know, what do you do? So that's kind of, you know, what each piece will look like on each side. And not every article will be, you know, kind of a two-part article.
Right.
But yeah, but we'll mix and match as we see fit.
When you're looking at the universe of startups, small business startups out there in Central Ohio and Columbus, and that, what are you seeing most of? Is it mostly service industry type things, food, that kind of a thing?
There's a couple of industries that are kind of hot right now. I mean, food is always one. I mean, everybody has to eat every day, so food businesses.
I love food shows.
Always spring up left and right. The big trend we're seeing right now is the food carts. I don't know if you've had someone on.
Mm-hmm.
I think recently. Did you?
We've talked about the carts, but I haven't had a cart person on yet.
Well, I definitely recommend doing that, because every day there's a new food cart.
They're pretty busy
up,
though, right around when I go on. 10 to 12, they're setting up their carts. You know,
get them to bring the cart in. And,
Okay, good idea.
So that's a really hot trend right now, because there's relatively little financial capital and overhead, and you know, you buy the cart, you make the food for the day, you know, you apply for the right permits and things like that, and you get up and running. You know, there's not a lot of build out and things like mm-hmm. that. So that's a big trend right now. The other thing, obviously, is the technology trend. We were recognized, I think, 2 years ago as an up and coming tech city. So we're seeing a lot of new businesses come out of institutions like Tech Columbus. You know, the university is definitely a heavy partner in that angle. The Dublin Entrepreneurial Center is very tech focused and online focused. So not every business is you know, kind of falls into the same category. It's a pretty diverse landscape out there.
Yeah, this is a spinoff from Columbus Underground. Were there other potential spinoffs or other things you're looking at?
Yeah, we talked about a couple different things. We talked about maybe putting together some sort of green resource. We actually get a lot of emails and suggestions saying you should do, you know, something more focused on sustainability, you know, whether it's, you know, in your home or your daily lives kind of thing, or focus on businesses and developments, you know, that have a focus on, you know, green. But it's such a wide topic, we weren't able to kind of narrow it down into something that made a lot of sense. We talked about some sort of parenting blog, being parents ourselves, talking about some of the resources that are in the community. Trying to think off the top of my head. This is like 5 or 6 months ago. We did this big brainstorming session, but there were like 5 or 6, and maybe we'll approach those down the road. But this is the one we thought had the most potential right now.
614-292-8513. Walker Evans will be with us for a few more minutes. So get on the phone and call us if you want to talk with Walker Evans. The Metropreneur, as you mentioned, it also functions as a virtual incubator. Mm-hmm. So is that just from people talking to each other that way?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's kind of integrated into everything that we're doing. We built this resource with the same mindset that we wanted it to be a community-oriented resource. You know, we want people to tell us what they want to know, you know, tell us what they want to hear, what we're not focusing on, what they want more information about. So that if people have an active interest in a topic or in finding more information, we're able to provide that for them and make it a very open, conversational, you know, two-way street. So we have built in some functionality for networking, some social networking in the site, as well as connected externally to our Twitter account, Facebook account, LinkedIn account, things like that. But yeah, we want this to play a little bit more of a proactive role in economic development. So if there are entrepreneurs out there thinking about taking that leap and starting a business, if we can help make that successful, then you know, we'll be happy at the end of the day. So that's kind of what we mean by virtual incubator.
You know, you mentioned social media. How big of a deal is that now in small business operations?
It's definitely big. I mean, a lot of businesses look to it as, you know, the easy way to spread. You know, I don't want to say free because it's obviously a big time commitment sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the way that makes a lot of sense for spreading word of mouth these days, you know, getting the message out, getting the word out on your business or your product. But about a month before we launched The Metropreneur, we started kind of an online social media teaser campaign so that we could build up our Twitter and Facebook followings and our email subscriber list so that on day one we had sort of a built-in audience. So we had around 1,000 people. It was up to about 1,300 when I looked this morning between Facebook and Twitter. So it's nice that whenever we publish a new story or have a new update, we've got that audience behind us.
So what are people chatting about now? Have they started to talk to each other?
Yeah. In the first week, you know, we published our kind of our launch stories.
Right.
I should say, too, this has been a team effort from day one. You know,
right.
I mentioned my wife, Anne. You know, she's kind of the operations director for this and doing a lot of the management behind the scenes stuff. We have Melanie McIntyre, who's our editorial director, who's doing a lot of the editorial content, working with some of our community partners who will be submitting articles and features and things like that. And then Jared Thompson, who's our advertising director. So we kind of put together this 4-person launch team to get this up and running.
So now you're employing several people.
Yeah. We're not only creating a resource that helps small businesses, we're growing as a small business.
You're growing as a small business. What does it feel like to be a small business? Because I know we've talked before, this all started out as sort of a
hobby.
Gee, I want to be a blogger kind of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. It, you know, when we started Columbus Underground almost 10 years ago, it was a hobby. And so for it to change and mutate and grow and our business to continue to grow in these other ways, it's been really rewarding. You know, I mean, working for yourself is a lot of fun, but being able to create jobs and energy and something that people take pride in and value in is really personally rewarding.
When I was reading the Q&A with Jenny, she made the point that if you think that you're going to start your own business and have a lot of free time and it's because you'll be in control of your time, forget about it.
Right.
Has that been your experience?
Definitely, yeah. Well, especially launching this new project, we've not gotten any sleep in the past like 2 or 3 weeks. But yeah, I always say that it's nice that you get to set your own hours, but it's...
They're 12 hours a day.
Yeah, usually about 18 hours a day.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, but it's, you know, it's fun. It doesn't feel like work, I should say.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about something a little off topic. The New York Times last month wrote about the image issue with Columbus. New York Times likes to write about Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
They just wrote about ice creams and Columbus popped up in that as well. Any thoughts about how the Metropreneur helps clarify or define an image for the city? Do you have any? I know you must have a really strong sense about what you'd like it. The image to be?
I don't, actually. I mean, I agree that imaging and branding is important and that it's something that as a city we need to continue to discuss and continue to figure out. I think some of the efforts have been a little I think the problem is that we're trying to be everything to everyone. And if you look at a lot of the other images that stand out or the branding efforts that stand out in other cities, they've pigeonholed themselves and they're delivering a message, whether it's to visitors, to tourists, to residents, that they're much more narrow in their focus. And I think our efforts, we're trying to make some sort of grand statement that everyone will appreciate, whether you're looking to visit the city for a day or move here for the rest of your life. And I don't think that sort of thing is going to work. So.
You can't just say, yay, Columbus.
Well, I do, but but that's – yeah, I don't know. I don't – there's no easy answer to – and I'm not going to pretend that I have the easy answer to that question. But it's definitely something that I love to discuss and love to, you know, to continue to talk about.
So what do you love about Columbus now? Everything?
Well, yeah, I mean, I love everything about the city. I mean, we you know, like I said, like we were talking about earlier, we've got a great, you know, food scene. We've got great theaters. We've got great events and festivals. You know, I have a small family. We've started a family here. So it's not only kid friendly. You know, we feel like we have enough to do with kids, but we can get a babysitter and go out and have plenty of things to do as adults. So I don't know. I mean, I love larger cities like New York and Chicago, and I love visiting. But I think if you move there, it kind of takes some of that magic away when you kind of get into the daily grind. And I'd love to just keep the cities that I love to visit as cities I love to visit and call Columbus home.
Don't go away and always come home to Columbus.
Right.
We have just about a minute and a half, 614-292-8513, if you want to squeeze in a question or comment for Walker Evans. How deep is the well of talent to feature on the site?
I think it's pretty deep. I mean, there are new businesses being started every day, and I think we're trying to focus on people doing very unique things, you know, something that stands out. And, you know, Melanie and I and Ann and I have sat down to talk about different story ideas. You know, we're getting suggestions in email. I don't think we're going to run out of ideas. And especially, you know, you consider someone like, again, Jenny, or let's go to a different media director. How about Liz Lesner?
Yeah, Liz Lesner.
Once a year she's opening a new restaurant. So there's always something to talk about. You know, there's always new entrepreneurial adventures, even with some of the folks that you've covered before. So I don't know. I think Columbus is a big enough city. There's always something to do and always, you know, people doing cool things.
How do you get your ideas?
Usually they come to me in the middle of the night.
Okay.
and I try and write them
down. Do you
down,
actually so get up and write them down? That's the key.
Well, I'm usually up anyway okay. In the middle of the night. But no, I mean, we come up with some ideas ourselves, but we get, you know, plenty of suggestions, you know, through Twitter, Facebook, email. You know, Melanie, our editorial director, has a background in business writing, so she's brought a lot to the table as far as different ways to focus on community. She did a really great article on Delaware, Ohio, how mm-hmm. they're kind of focusing
right.
on their downtown. The new Columbus State campus opened up there, and they've got a lot of workforce development type classes. So she did a great kind of regional spotlight on that, and that's something we're going to continue to feature.
Okay, we're out of time.
Cool.
Walker Evans, thanks for joining us again today and tell us about your new project.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's The Metropreneur. You can see it online. You can go to columbusunderground.com and see that as well. Both of them are the brainchild of Walker Evans and his group of co-conspirators, I guess.
Yes.
I don't know. And good luck with it.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
That's all the time we have for All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.